Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lady Eve's Indiscretion by Grace Burroughs, narrated by James Langton. 1.
What you seek to accomplish, my lord, is arguably impossible.
Ernest Hooker shuffled files while he sat in judgment of the Marquis of Dean's aspirations. When the ensuing silence stretched more than a few moments, the solicitor readjusted his neckcloth, cleared his throat, and shifted his inkwell 1 inch closer to the edge of the blotter centred on his gargantuan desk. Two of his minions watched the client, whom they no doubt expected to rant and throw things in the grand family tradition, from a careful distance. Lucas Denning, newly minted Marquis of Dean, took out the gold watch Marie had given him when he'd come down from university. The thing had stopped for lack of timely winding, but Dean made it a point to stare at his timepiece before speaking.
"Impossible, Hooker. I'm curious as to the motivation for such hyperbole from a man of the law."
One clerk glanced nervously at the other when Hooker stopped fussing with his files.
"My lord, you cannot mean to deprive a man of the company of his legitimate offspring."
Hooker's pudgy, lily-white hands continued to fiddle with the accoutrements of his trade.
"We're discussing a girl child, true, but one in her father's possession in even the simplest sense. The courts do not exist to satisfy anybody's whims, and you can't expect them to pluck that child from her father's care and place her in yours. You have no children of your own, my lord, no wife, no experience raising children, and you've yet to see to your own succession. Even were the man demented, the courts would likely consider other possibilities before placing the girl in your care."
Dean snapped the watch shut.
"I heard her mother's dying wishes. That should count for something. Wellington wrote me up in the dispatches often enough."
One of the other men came forward, a prissier, desiccated version of Hooker, with fewer chins and less hair.
"My lord, do you proceed on dying declarations alone? That will land you in Chancery, where you'll be lucky to have the case heard before the girl reaches her majority, and endorsements of a man's wartime abilities by the Iron Duke are all well and good, but consider that raising children, most especially young girl children, should not have much in common with battling the Corsican."
An insult lurked in that soft reply, but truth as well. Every street sweeper in London knew the futility of resorting to the Court of Chancery. The clerk had not exaggerated about the delays and idiosyncrasies of that institution.
"I'm sorry, my lord," Hooker rose, while Dean remained seated. "We look forward to serving the Marquisate in all of its legal undertakings, but in this, I'm afraid, we cannot honestly advise you to proceed."
Dean got to his feet, taking small satisfaction from being able to look down his nose, quite literally, at the useless ciphers whose families he kept housed and fed.
"Draw up the pleadings, anyway."
He stalked out of the room, the urge to destroy something, to pitch Hooker's idiot files into the fire, to snatch up the fireplace poker and lay about with it, nigh overcoming his self-discipline.
"My lord."
The third man had the temerity to follow Dean from the room, which was going to serve as a wonderful excuse for Dean's long-denied display of frustration. A marquis did not have tantrums, when Dean realized the man was carrying a pair of well-made leather gloves.
"My thanks."
Dean snatched the gloves from the man's hand, but to his consternation the fellow held on to the gloves for a bit, making for a short tug of war.
"If your lordship has one more moment."
The clerk let the gloves go. The exchange had been bizarre enough to penetrate Dean's ire, mostly because, between Hooker and Sons and the Marquis of Dean, obsequies were the order of the day and had been for generations.
"Speak." Dean pulled on a glove. "You're obviously ready to burst with some crumb of legal wisdom your confreres were not inclined to share."
"Not legal wisdom, my lord."
The man glanced over his shoulder at the closed door behind them.
"Simple common sense.
You'll not be able to wrest the girl from her father through litigious means, but there are other ways.
Yes, there were. Most of them illegal, dangerous, and unethical, but tempting. Dean yanked on the second glove.
If I provoke him to a duel, Dolan stands an even chance of putting out my lights, sir, a consummation my cousin and sole heir claims would serve him very ill. I doubt I'd enjoy it myself.
This fellow was considerably younger than the other two, with an underfed, scholarly air about him, and a pair of wire-rimmed glasses gracing his nose. The man drew himself up, as if preparing for oral argument.
I do not advocate murder, my lord, but every man, every person, has considerations motivating them. The girl's father is noted to be mindful of his social standing and his wealth.
Vulgarly so.
Your point?
If you offer him something he wants more than he wants to torment you over the girl, he might part with her. The problem isn't legal. The solution might not be legal either.
If there was sense in what the young man was saying, Dean was too angry to pass it out.
My thanks. I will consider the not-legal alternatives, as you suggest. Good day.
My lord, that wasn't what I meant.
Dean was down the stairs and out the door before the idiot could finish his sentence. Fortunately for all in Dean's path, his coachman was just bringing the horses around the corner at a sedate walk. Dean climbed in before the vehicle even stopped moving. Anthony Denning folded down his edition of the Times, his expression impassive.
Any luck with your pet weasels?
Dean appropriated the spot beside him, since Anthony was on the forward-facing seat.
They were waiting for me to lay waste to the office from the moment I arrived.
Uncle once said that was the best way to get their attention.
Dean stared out the window, knowing Anthony was simply trying to make conversation.
His tempers were just another way for him to feel powerful while incurring ridiculous costs and earning a reputation as a dangerous lunatic.
Anthony set the paper aside as Dean banged twice on the roof quite stoutly. The horses moved up to the trot, only to come back to the walk two blocks later.
I should have ridden.
You should have let me accompany you,
Anthony said. He had the knack of sounding not like he was scolding, which he was, but like he was saddened to have been denied an opportunity to serve.
You'll make a lousy marquis when Dolan douses my lights, Anthony. I appreciate the support, but my problems with Dolan are personal.
Anthony bore the same Denning family features as his cousin, blue eyes, wavy blonde hair, a lanky build, and decent features. He'd look like a Marquis of Dean, but he'd never be able to carry out the displays of temper, incontinent drinking, and excesses of sexual indulgence polite society expected of the title holder. Anthony did, however, make a fine supervisor to the myriad Dean land stewards, for which Dean was shamelessly grateful.
I'll take Beast out this afternoon, prior to the fashionable hour. Perhaps some carousing tonight will improve my humour as well.
Anthony picked up his newspaper, a bland smile on his face.
A man newly out of mourning cannot neglect his carousing. Once the season starts, you'll be waltzing the night away. Then there's every house party and shooting party in the land to attend, while each ambitious mamma in the realm tries to put you on a leash for her darling daughter.
If you're trying to cheer me up, cousin, you are failing spectacularly.
Though the solicitors had mentioned that a man with a wife might stand a better chance in the courts than one without. What a dolorous, uncomfortable thought. Lady Eve Wyndham's great fall had happened on her 16th birthday. In the eyes of polite society, it was a bad fall from a fast horse. Evie's family knew it to be a fall from grace, while Eve understood it to be a fall of even more disastrous dimensions than that, a long, hard fall involving injury to her heart, not just her left wrist and hip, and requiring years of convalescence. 7 years later, she found something ominously biblical about the length of time. She still hadn't gotten back on a horse, nor entirely mended her heart. Neither situation merited much notice, though, because she'd been born the youngest daughter of their graces, the Duke and Duchess of Morland. The Wyndham family's consequence was such that the exact nature of this youthful indiscretion was never allowed to reach the ears of the gossips, sparing Eve that most inconvenient and troublesome Wyndham family tradition, great scandal. Great scandal might as well have the status of a great aunt, so frequently did it come to call upon the Wyndhams. His Grace's offspring included two byblows, both fortunately conceived prior to his acquisition of the title, and also, God be thanked, before his acquisition of a duchess. When Wyndhams married, the firstborn was typically not a 9 months babe. In fact, nobody could recall when a Wyndham firstborn had been a 9 months babe, not even back to the present Duke's late grandfather. And yet, Wyndham infants were notoriously healthy from birth. The Wyndham sisters had, by a narrow margin, evaded what amounted to the family curse. With Maggie and Sophie wed, that margin was so narrow as to suggest Wyndham brides conceived on their very wedding nights. The third Wyndham sister to marry, Louisa, Countess of Kesmore, was being closely watched to see if she too was going to present her earl with an heir in such spanking time. Eve Wyndham, by contrast, had no intention of allowing herself to encounter those circumstances conducive to the subsequent appearance of a baby. Not now, not ever. And therein lay a problem of disastrous, even scandalous, proportions, for no less a person than Esther, her Grace, the Duchess of Morland, had lately taken a notion to see her two remaining unwed daughters escorted up the aisle. Locked in wed, as Eve's brothers used to say. All three brothers were married now, and saying very different things indeed.
"Smile, Evie, Trottenham is on his way over."
Eve pasted the requisite smile on her face and glanced around the ballroom.
"Be still, my tender heart."
The tone of her words was at variance with their content, which caused Eve's sister Genevieve to smile as well.
"He's not so bad, or you wouldn't have given him a minuet."
Eve said nothing, as her latest admiring swain wove ever closer through the crowd. Jenny was right, he wasn't so bad, or so good. He'd serve as one of this season's decoys, if need be. Eve kept her smile in place, though the thought of another entire season, months, of social prevarication made her oppressively tired.
"My lady!"
Trottenham bowed over her hand, bringing his heels together like some stuffy Prussian officer.
"Mr. Trottenham, a pleasure."
Though it wasn't.
"I believe the sets are forming for my dance."
He wiggled his blonde eyebrows, probably his attempt at flirtation. Jenny took a whiff of her wrist corsage, though Eve thought her sister might be hiding a smirk. Eve placed her gloved fingers over his hand, and for the thousandth time prepared to tread that fine line between reeling a man in and casting him away. In the course of the dance she batted her eyes, though twice she forgot the name of Mr. Trottenham's estate. She let him hold her a trifle too close, as she tittered. The grating titter was a rarefied art form.
"Lady Eve, has my conversation grown tiresome?"
Trottenham twirled her gently under his arm while he spoke, and the slight resulting vertigo was Eve's first clue she was in trouble.
"Nonsense, Mr. Trottenham. I'm merely concentrating a bit on the steps of the dance."
She treated him to her most fatuous simper, while sounds around her altered as if from far away, including the sound of Eve's own voice. Each sound became both clearer, more detached from other noises, and less real.
"One can't expect such a pretty little lady to dance and follow a conversation."
Trottenham beamed an indulgent smile at her.
"Though my sisters tell me—"
He prattled on, while Eve dealt with the peculiar sense that her head was 3 feet wide and that she could feel sensations with her hair. By the time the dance concluded, the visual distortions had begun.
"Jenny, I must leave."
Eve kept her voice down. The next afflictions would be nausea and much worse vertigo, and there was no way on earth Eve could afford talk to circulate that she had been unwell or dizzy at a social function.
Jenny's perpetual smile dimmed.
"Is it a megrim, dearest?"
"A bad one, though there was no such thing as a good megrim. There must have been red wine in the punch.
Mama's playing cards with Aunt Gladys. I can fetch her and have the coach brought around.
There's not time." Before Eve's eyes, odd lights began to pulse around Jenny's head.
"Dean is here. He can see you home."
Eve made no protest, which was surely a measure of abject misery.
"Fetch him."
Jenny moved off while Eve sidled closer to the French doors, letting in fresh air from the terrace. The season was still a few weeks off, so the night was brisk. The darkness beckoned, as did the quiet. Quiet and darkness were her only friends when a headache struck. Laudanum was a last resort, lest she become dependent on it.
"Lady Eve,"
Dean stood before her, tall and strikingly handsome in his evening finery. He bowed over her hand, doing a credible impersonation of a proper gentleman.
"You don't look well."
How perceptive. At least he'd spoken quietly. She managed to bat her eyes at him.
"Get me out of here without causing talk. Please."
His gaze travelled over her quickly, assessingly. Eve would have hated that, except it was a completely impersonal inventory.
"A breath of fresh air is in order." "Dean, nobody is going to believe."
He tucked her hand over his arm, beamed a brilliant smile at her, and led her out to the terrace. As soon as they'd gained the edge of the illumination cast by the torches, he paused and took off his jacket.
"Unless you start squawking, nobody remarked our departure."
He settled his jacket over Eve's shoulders and gave the lapels a little tug to bring it close around her. Eve's first impression was of blessed warmth.
"Thank you." "My pleasure."
He didn't exactly sneer the words, but neither were they sincere. No matter. If he could get Eve home without further embarrassment, she'd suspend their skirmishing for one evening and be grateful. He offered his arm again.
"There's a gate this way we can use."
Eve hadn't meant to hesitate, but it was difficult even to think when that ominous ache started up at the base of her skull.
"For God's sake, Eve Wyndham, it was just a kiss under the mistletoe. Probably inspired by your papa's wassail more than anything else."
She had to put her hand on his arm, while the feeling of the ground shifting beneath her feet swept over her.
"My brothers said it was white rum." "The occasional tot makes the holiday socializing less tedious. You really do not look well."
The last observation was grudging, almost worried.
"I did not mean to swill from your glass, Dean. You should have stopped me."
They had to get to the coach. The night felt like it was closing in, and Dean's voice, a perfect example of male aristocratic euphony, was swelling and shrinking in the oddest way.
"I might have stopped you, except you downed the whole drink before I realized what was afoot, and then you were accosting me in the most passionate—"
Eve clutched his arm and swayed into him, breathing shallowly through her mouth.
"If you insist on arguing with me, my lord, I will be ill all over these bushes." "Why didn't you say so?"
He slipped an arm around her waist and promenaded her down the steps. By the time they got to the garden gate, the nausea was subsiding, though Eve was leaning heavily on her escort. She had the notion that the scents of cedar and lavender coming from Dean's jacket might have helped quiet her stomach. Dean ushered her through the gate, which put them on a quiet, mercifully dark side street.
"How often do these headaches befall you?"
"Too often. Sometimes I go for months between attacks, sometimes only days. The worst is when it hits on one side, subsides for a day, then strikes on the other."
Dean pulled one of his gloves off with his teeth, then used two fingers to give a piercing three-blast whistle.
"Sorry."
All the while he kept his arm around Eve's waist, a solid, warm, and quite unexpected bulwark against complete disability.
"The coach will be here in moments. Is there anything that helps?"
"Absolute quiet. Absolute dark. Time."
Though her mother used to rub her neck, and that had helped the most. He said nothing more. Dean wasn't stupid, and Eve just leaned on him. Her grandmother had apparently suffered from these same headaches, though neither Eve's parents nor her siblings were afflicted.
The clip-clop of hooves sounded like so much gunfire in Eve's head, but it was the sound of privacy, so Eve tried to welcome it. Dean gave the coachee directions to the Wyndham mansion and climbed in after Eve.
"Shall I sit beside you, my lady?"
An odd little courtesy that he would even ask.
"Please, the less I move, the less uncomfortable I am."
He settled beside her and looped an arm around her shoulders. Without a single thought for dignity, skirmishes, or propriety, Eve laid her head on his shoulder, closed her eyes, and was grateful. To see Eve Wyndham brought low ought to have been satisfying in some private, ungentlemanly regard. Instead, Dean felt unwelcome inclinations toward protectiveness, and, it was hard to admit such a thing even to himself, helplessness. And if there was one feeling he resented with a passion, it was helplessness where a female was concerned. Small, silent, and miserable beside him, Lady Eve was obviously suffering with every bump over the cobbles and turn on the streets.
"Evie, is there anything I can do?"
The name had slipped out, harking back to a time when he'd been more an older brother by association to his fellow officers' sisters.
"Evie?"
She cuddled closer, like a suffering animal looking for relief.
"My mamma used to rub my neck. I hate this."
She was helpless too, he realized, and equally unhappy about it. How strange that after growing increasingly quarrelsome with each other, they'd find pride as their common ground. This temporary truce put him in mind of the way the French and British armies would declare an unspoken détente regarding the use of rivers and streams flowing between their respective warring camps on the peninsula.
"Let's try something."
He pulled a lap rug from under the padded bench and spread it over his knees.
"Down you go."
With him braced against a corner of the coach, he eased Eve face down over the makeshift pillow on his knees. When she made no protest, he found her nape with his bare hand and started a slow massage.
"Does that help?"
"Heavenly."
He could feel her ease somewhat, though in deference to her condition, the horses were moving only at a walk.
"Shall I take your pins out?"
"Please, God, I can feel them. My hair hurts."
He might have smiled, but her torment was obvious in her voice. Carefully, so carefully, he eased the pins from her coiffure until her hair hung down in a long golden braid. She was unmoving against him while he alternated between gently squeezing the sides of her neck and rubbing her nape. They would not speak of this peculiar interlude, and Dean had been a fool to bring up their one stupid kiss at Christmas past. Eve had been adorably tipsy, having swiped his glass of thoroughly spiked punch, and he'd enjoyed the effects of the alcohol on her demeanour, enjoyed her passionate, artless, determined kisses much more and much longer than he should have. She'd been a cheerful, even mischievous girl, dear and sweet and easy to tease. With her brother Bart's death, something had changed, and not for the better. When Dean had made some courtesy calls after selling his commission, he'd found Eve Wyndham to be punctiliously proper, stiff, and even chilly toward him, though Bart had more than intimated that the lady had her reasons. She wasn't chilly now. She was utterly undone. It pleased him not at all to see it. He had, though, been pleased to find himself accosted in the coat closet out at Morland's over the holidays. The old Eve had been there in that kiss, wicked, sweet, playful, but also all grown up in the best places.
"Eve, we're here. Shall I carry you?"
She sat up slowly, her hand going to her forehead.
"I can walk."
Or she'd crawl, or expire of pride in the filth of the mews, before she'd allow him to assist her where others might notice. He handed her out of the carriage, and any fool could see she was none too steady on her feet.
"You can ring a peal over my head later, my lady."
"Dean, no."
Such a weak protest wasn't going to deter him from scooping her up against his chest and proceeding toward the house.
"For once in your stubborn life, hush, your brothers would expect this much of me."
The reference to her brothers was intended as a sop to her pride and a warning. It was also the truth.
In addition to the late Lord Bart, Dean had also served with Devlin St. Just, now Earl of Rosecroft. If Rosecroft got wind Evie had received cavalier treatment when in distress, a friendship Dean valued greatly would falter, to say nothing of what the lady's father would do to Dean should Morland learn his daughter had been allowed to suffer needlessly.
"Where are you taking me?"
"Inside." He'd run tame in this house for years, so he was able to clarify. "To your room." He managed the service door off the kitchen, it being the family practice not to lock it until everyone was in for the night. Two flights up had him in the family wing, where he himself had been an occasional guest.
"Which door, Evie?"
"Don't call me that. Next one on the right."
The listlessness of her scold rankled, and when Eve's lady's maid came scampering out of the dressing room, Dean felt a reluctance to surrender his burden.
"Lady Eve is suffering a megrim. You'll want to fetch the lavender water and perhaps a tot of the poppy. You're not to brush out her hair or do anything other than exactly as she directs."
The woman's expression suggested she'd never beheld her lady in a strange gentleman's arms, much less in the confines of the lady's own apartments.
"I'll take good care of her, my lord."
"See that you do."
He wanted to deposit Evie on the bed, but her dignity would not thank him. Carefully he set her on her feet, keeping an arm around her shoulders.
"Turn down the bed, Hammett."
Eve's voice was a weary thread of sound.
"Please."
The maid bustled off to put coals in the bed warmer, leaving Dean to peer down at the woman half leaning on him.
"Shall I alert anybody?"
"Hammett is used to this. Good night, Dean, and thank you."
She went up on her toes, blinked her pretty green eyes at him once, then kissed his cheek and subsided on a sigh. After that, there was nothing for Dean to do but bow courteously over her hand and take his leave.
"Papa?"
"Oui, mon coeur."
Mischievous blue eyes peered up at Jonathan Patrick Francis Dolan.
"Why don't you speak the Irish any more? I hear it only if you sing to me."
Dolan smiled down at the prettiest female he'd ever beheld.
"Because a proper lady knows her French."
He turned a page in a worn copy of Robinson Crusoe.
"Shall I read about poor Crusoe in French?"
Translating as he went would be a challenge for a man who'd picked up his French on the docks of Calais, but for her he'd muddle along.
"Please don't."
Georgina shifted on the sofa beside him.
"Miss Ingram makes me recite in French every morning. Will you sing to me tonight?"
8 years old, and already she was learning to wheedle. He didn't know whether to be proud or dismayed.
"Will you apply yourself to your French, a coach le macrae?"
She pursed her lips, while Dolan ran his hand over a tiny golden braid. Thank a merciful God she'd gotten her mother's English blonde locks, and not Dolan's unruly auburn hair. He'd stopped up in the nursery suite, when he should have been down in his office reviewing the accounts of any number of lazy subcontractors, thieving factors, and useless suppliers. The next thing he knew, he'd been cozened into reading just a few pages of an old favourite, and an hour had gone by. Not a wasted hour, but a precious hour stolen from a press of business that never left him enough time with his only child.
"Tell you what," he said, setting the book aside, "if Miss Ingram gives a good account of your French, I'll sing to you tomorrow night."
"Why not tonight?"
"I'm going out, my heart, and you are going to mind Miss Ingram, say your prayers, and dream sweet dreams."
She reached for the book and laid it open on her lap.
"I'll dream of a pony."
"Learn your French, and I'll get a pony for you to keep at Whitley."
The look she gave him was curiously adult.
"He won't go to Whitley until it's summer, and it's not even completely spring yet."
Before she could start needling him, Dolan kissed her crown and rose.
"Learn your French, Georgina, dearest, and then you'll be in a stronger bargaining position."
"You'll start on my needlepoint next. I'll never get a pony."
Fortunately, she was grinning.
"Who wants a pony when there are magical unicorns to be had?"
He tapped her nose with one calloused finger and took himself off, before she could tell him there were no unicorns. The first time she'd informed her father of this truth, Dolan had permitted himself a wee drop of medicinal whisky, despite it being broad daylight. He'd recognized it as the beginning of a slippery slide away from the innocence.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?